stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
Why do Catholics worship Mary?
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest? Where is purgatory in the Bible?
What's stopping
you? I think the Pope has too much authority.
What's stopping you? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. It's the program for our non-Catholic listeners. Those of you who have questions about the Catholic faith, you're not quite sure how to get those answers, we are here for you. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response, and once you get it, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also send us an email. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles is our producer, Matt Kabinski handling the phones, Rich Jesse on social media. If you would like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming on both those platforms right now. Just put your question in the comments box, if you would, please. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am well. How are you, my friend?
You know, I'm doing decent, thank you.
I'm glad to hear it. We're going to lead off with a golden oldie.
Okay.
This is a question that comes up again and again, and I think it's probably a misconception. This is from Virgil, who says, can you explain the doctrine of papal infallibility? Based on the history of this institution, it seems very hard to believe.
Oh, yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. Actually, I think the history of the institution is one of the strongest proofs in favor of the doctrine.
Yeah.
Right? Because the doctrine says that the Pope can be wrong a lot of times. That the Pope can be tremendously and magnificently wrong lots of times, that the Pope can be deeply immoral, that the Pope can make, like, grotesquely imprudent decisions, and that the Pope can even make theological errors when he's operating as a private theologian and even in the conduct of his ordinary teaching office. So, like, you know, when the Pope gets up and preaches a homily, when he says Mass, for example, he could say something and you could step and go, do what, Pope? What did you just say? You know, as has happened in history, right?
Yes,
you know, and,
yes.
You know, one of my favorite examples is John the 22nd, who manifestly taught, but not infallibly, error. He taught an erroneous doctrine, and everybody knew it was erroneous, and all the theologians at the time said, Pope, you might want to rethink that. Pope doubled down on his erroneous doctrine, but eventually recanted towards the end of his life and said, well, you know, I was just operating as a private theologian and I didn't define it and blah, 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 blah. And the next pope came out with an infallible declaration that corrected John the 22nd's error. So papal infallibility is compatible with all of that, okay? And so if you find popes behaving like human beings and doing ridiculously stupid things as human beings are wont to do, you'll go, aha, the church says the pope is not some superpowered superhero that always does what's right. There he is proving exactly what the church says about him, right? Okay. What the church says is that in very restricted circumstances, that the Pope can confirm something that belongs to the deposit of faith. That is to say, it's a teaching that the Christian church has held from the beginning because it was something that God revealed. And God revealed it either in sacred scripture or in the person of Christ or in the teaching of the apostles. And so it's not something the Pope makes up, right? It's something that's been there all along, but something typically that's been called into controversy, and maybe someone has proposed a bad interpretation of some aspect of the deposit of faith. And so adverting back to that deposit of faith, the Pope says, no, here's the right way to understand that. And in fact, this is the way the church has always understood it. And everybody has got to get on board with this so that we have unanimity in the church.
Okay.
And he uses very specific language. He says things like, I infallibly define. It's kind of hard to miss, actually, when he says this.
Yeah.
Very, very rarely does the Pope do this. And councils, too, have this power of infallibility. And so, you know, a sort of classic case would be the Council of Nicaea defining the dogma of the Blessed Trinity. You know, that's not, you can't revise that. You can't go back on that one. You can't say, oh, well, Nicaea made a mistake. No, Nicaea did not make a mistake. They got that one right, okay? When the Fourth Lateran Council defined the dogma of transubstantiation, well, they got that one right. We're not backing off of that one. But when John the 22nd said that he thought that the souls of the just would sleep until the resurrection, he was wrong on that, but he didn't infallibly define it.
Okay, very good. Virgil, we hope that clears things up for you. Appreciate your email. Here's one now from Grace, and I think I know what you're going to say. Are my prayers effective if I pray for a non-believing person?
Oh, that's a great question. Let me reframe it.
Okay.
Can you pray on behalf of a non-believing person, and is it possible that that prayer can be efficacious or effective? Of course, absolutely. Yes, definitely. I mean, there's plenty of situations in sacred scripture and in the lives of the saints when exactly this sort of thing happened. Okay, mm-hmm. If such a thing were not possible, it would make no sense to pray for someone's conversion.
That's true.
Right.
Yeah.
You can absolutely do this. Will your specific prayers for that specific person be efficacious? Well, I have no way of knowing that.
Okay.
The sacred scripture says that our prayers are more efficacious as we are more righteous. The prayer of a righteous man availeth much, says St. James. Mm-hmm. He also says that those of us that aren't so righteous, we don't availeth a whole lot, right? Okay, and he actually talks about the distinction in his epistle. You know, you're praying and not getting what you ask for, he says, because you ask with wrong motives. Well, Anders, praying for somebody's conversion, I could never have a wrong motive there, could I? Oh, you bet you could. Absolutely you could. What if your motive in praying for someone's conversion, secretly, maybe even unknown to yourself, was, I want them to admit I'm right.
Ooh, ouch.
If they come to see the world the way I see it, then they'll know I was right all along, and all those times they put me down, I'll finally be vindicated. Is that the right motive? Maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe that's not love of neighbor that's motivating you,
yeah.
Right? You see? But if you're genuinely motivated by the love of God and neighbor, and you really are genuinely motivated to see God's will done, well, here's the nice thing. God's will is always done. Like,
yes,
the question is, am I on board with it or not? And the more I'm on board with God's will, guess what? The more likely my prayers are to be answered. God, let me win the lottery so I can go to Vegas. Maybe not.
Maybe not.
Maybe not.
Grace, thanks so much for your email. If you would like to send us an email for a future show, here's the address, especially for you folks watching us on TV, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Hey, lines are open for you right now. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. Do stay with us. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you call right now, you will get in. 833-288-EWTN. Let me tell you about a wonderful book now available from EWTN's religious catalog. As you probably know, we're in the midst of a historic birth dearth. So why do some 5% of American women choose to defy the demographic norm by bearing 5 or more children? This book that we're talking about here, Hannah's Children, is a compelling portrait of these overlooked but fascinating mothers who, like the biblical Hannah, see their children as their purpose, their contribution, and their greatest blessing. Social scientist and author Catherine Pakulik, herself the mother of 8, traveled across the United States. She interviewed 55 college-educated women who were raising 5 or more kiddos. Through open-ended questions, she sought to understand who these women are, why and when they chose to have that large family, and what this choice means for them, their families, and our nation. More than interesting stories of extraordinary women, she presents information that's urgently relevant for the future of American prosperity. Here is the name of the book, Hannah's Children, The Women Quietly Defying the Birth Dearth by Catherine Pakulik. It's available now at EWTNRC.com. Buy Catholic, shop Catholic, EWTNRC.com. All right, we're going to go to the phones in just a couple of minutes. First, a quick question from Nicholas, watching us on YouTube today. Nicholas says, I want to be Catholic, but I live in a rural area. There doesn't appear to be an OCIA nearby. I personally am legally blind and cannot drive. What should I do?
Yeah, thanks. So here's what I would do if I were you. First of all, I would find out what the closest geographical parish is to you.
Okay.
And also, I don't know what diocese you're writing in from, but I'd find out what your diocese is.
Yeah.
And then I would reach out, first of all, to that parish. And if you don't get any luck there, I'd reach out to the education office at your diocese and explain your situation.
So yeah.
You would like to be received into the church, but you're disabled and don't have access to an RCA class. And what can they do for you? And you know, the church wants you in the church, and they're pretty good at making accommodations for people when they need to. But I also would advise you to, you know, don't just knock once and give up. If you encounter, say, a church secretary who says, "Oh, we don't do that," well, try to get around that church secretary.
Yeah.
You know, and ask the priest directly. And if that doesn't work, ask another one. You will, if you knock, the door will be opened.
Sure,
I promise.
Sure.
In my own case, when I became Catholic, I knocked on three doors. I went to three parishes and three priests before I found one that was enthusiastic about receiving me into the church. So that's kind of a blight, you know, but I'm telling you the truth that I wanted to be Catholic. I went looking until somebody would receive me into the church.
And I have a blind friend who did exactly what you are saying. He knocked around, you know, knocked on those doors, looked around, and finally got the answer. Today he is a Catholic.
You know, we have, this is not your situation, but not infrequently, we have truck drivers that listen to EWTN on satellite radio, and they're always on the road, and every once in a while they'll call up and say, "Well, I've decided to become a Catholic, but I'm always on the road, so I mean, I can't be consistently at the church at Wednesday night at 6:30 p.m., because I might be four states away. What do I do?" And one fellow, I remember telling him, I said, "Look, you know, even if the priest can't privately instruct you, go find yourself a deacon. Like, go get a deacon and say, he can do this legally, right?
Sure.
So I want to be Catholic. I need private instruction because I can't go to the class." And you just keep working until you find one. And then he says, "Great." And the guy calls back about 3 weeks later and says, "I got me my deacon," right? And then we're like, "Great, fantastic." And then, you know, 6 months later, he calls to tell us that he's being received into the church at Easter. So it can happen.
Nicholas, be not afraid. It can happen. There are workarounds in cases like yours. Thanks so much for watching us today on YouTube. We're going to get to the phones in a moment. Waiting for your call at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Rosa sent us this email. What does the church teach about women deacons?
Yeah, well, deacon, the diaconate as the first grade of holy orders, because it's the first grade of holy orders, is open only to men, right? Because it's like it's the step in the door towards the priesthood.
Sure.
And priesthood is reserved to men only. In antiquity, there were women who had an office of service in the church. And the Greek word that means to serve or servant is the same one that we use for the office of deacon. And so it's a little bit ambiguous in, say, the first and second centuries. Sometimes you're talking about the office. Sometimes the word is used in reference to somebody who just has a position in which they serve. But it's not the first grade of holy orders, you
see. Okay.
And so there were some women in antiquity that you may find a reference or two in a kind of diaconal, that is, service-oriented ministry. But it's clear from the context that what they did were things in the church that were would have been unsuitable for men to do, right? So a classic example would be from time to time you might have a woman make an accusation of physical abuse against her husband to the bishop. And so the church would need to investigate the claim, and that might involve, say, looking at evidence of bruising on a woman's body, something that would be indecent for a man to do.
Yep.
They would delegate that task to a woman, quote-unquote, you know, a diaconal service. Another one would be sometimes in some places, baptism, believe it or not, was performed with, let us say, less than the usual amount of clothing on.
Oh.
And they made arrangements to protect the modesty of women. Again, something they would want a woman to do, right? We were not talking about people who were preaching and baptizing and marrying and burying.
I see.
And the priestly functions of the diaconate are not
right.
What were in view here.
Very good. And Rosa, thanks so much for your email. Calls are coming in right now. Love to talk with you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. All right, here's one now from Russell. My Orthodox friend was trying to convince me that priests should be married. He used 1 Timothy 3:2. How can I respond to this?
Okay, that's fine. Orthodox priests should be married. Great. wonderful. Maybe Catholic Eastern Rite priests should be married occasionally when they have that vocation. Great, fantastic. Maybe married Latin Rite priests should be married. In fact, I can tell you 100% they should be, because they are, right? I mean, we have priests in the Latin Rite that are married.
We do.
Since they're married, they had darn well better stay married, right? You know, we don't look kindly on people abandoning their wives. They should 100% be married, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The question is, does the church do wrong to, as it were, privilege and recruit celibate men to the priesthood? All right?
Yeah.
And there is a strong argument for doing so. There's a strong argument for doing it. Namely, the celibacy of Christ as the model high priest, celibacy of the Apostle Paul as the model missionary, who explicitly says, the way I'm doing this is the better way. Right? Because the celibate priest can give himself entirely to the service of the church and the gospel. But there are allowances for other paths, and there are other vocations in the church. But in the Latin Rite of the church has historically always favored a celibate priesthood, with exceptions.
With exceptions. Very good. And Russell, thanks so much for your question. Adam is watching us on YouTube today. Adam says, is it true that Pope Francis included women in a council or something of that kind that advised him about appointing bishops, or do I remember this incorrectly?
No, Francis went out of his way to try to appoint women to a number of positions in the Vatican. Personally, I think that's a great idea, and I think that the church ought to consult lay people, particularly when it comes to the care of lay people, right? You know,
yeah.
I mean, and there have been periods in the church's history when the laity had more or less influence on things like the appointment of bishops and the appointment of priests.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, for, say, the first 1,000 years in the Latin West, the laity had a tremendous amount of influence. I mean, tremendous amount of influence over the appointment of clerics, up to the point where, particularly in the manorial system of Europe, the suzerain, the lord of a particular manor, basically just appointed the local parish priest. I mean, it was just his decision. The guy served at his whim and his beck and call.
Yeah, yeah.
And the emperors, the Holy Roman Emperor, did the same thing with bishops.
Mm.
And occasionally with popes. Now, that eventually came to a head in the 12th century, and the papacy pushed back and said, okay, even if the laity have influence over who gets appointed bishop, at the end of the day, it's the Pope that needs to invest them with the signs of their office.
Sure.
And so we had what was called the investiture controversy over who got to actually invest the bishop with the sign of his office. And the Holy Roman Emperor pushed back, and the Pope pushed back, and eventually the Pope came out ahead. And canon law, the system of canon law we have in the church now, really dates from that period, from about the 12th century, Gratian's uh-huh. Decretals, which had sort of systematized a lot of the ancient canons, kind of drew them together. It really comes into existence around the time of the investiture controversy, when the church was pushing back. And so, you know, particularly in the Latin West, became a tradition of really sort of highlighting the power and the uniqueness of bishops and popes and the priesthood, you know, over clerical affairs. But with this understanding that historically that's not the only model of governance that the church has witnessed.
Yeah.
And even in the 20th century, particularly in hostile regimes, the papacy is often engaged in a kind of real politique, if you will, where they have to enter into dialogue with secular governments and other forces to kind of negotiate a candidate that would be acceptable to both. I mean, the Pope could come in and go, okay, I appoint this guy bishop. And if he's, say, in, you know, communist Eastern Europe behind the Iron Curtain, the communist government could go, oh, great, we'll go kill that guy. You know, I mean, like you could stand on principle all day, and then you'll never get a bishop in office because he sets foot in his see, and the government arrests him and throws him off into Siberia. You know, so if you actually want to have a pastor on the ground serving the people, it became necessary to consult with even hostile lay forces in order to find a candidate that the government would actually allow to serve. Now,
yeah.
Interestingly. Communist government, Eastern Europe, really made a gross miscalculation in the case of Karol Wojtyla.
Boy, howdy.
They thought, oh, he's not political. He's not political. He won't be a threat.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is he found a way to make not political extraordinarily political.
He did.
He turned not political into a political statement. When he went back as Pope to Poland and he, you know, made this papal address, and he never once mentioned communism or the communist government.
Didn't have to.
And he stressed the Catholic heritage of Poland and its Christian roots, and really drew the entire country's population, drew to their attention the utter irrelevance of communism for their cultural identity and its Johnny come lately status, and without ever mentioning politics, undermined the political system.
I remember that whole era so well, and it was just, it made me smile.
Oh yeah,
it really, really did. Hey Adam, thanks for watching us on YouTube. We got a call from Carl in Jefferson City, Missouri, who said, "I'd like to thank that visually impaired person who asked Dr. Anders how to join the church. It made me realize that I, too, can and should become Catholic. Thank you for your answer."
Oh, I really appreciate that. Yeah.
Pretty awesome. All right, if you're ready to go to the phones, let's do it. 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Steve in Houston, listening on the EWTN app. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today, sir?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I have a question for Dr. Anders. I've been looking at this laying on of hands. When Christ laid hands to pass the Holy Spirit to the apostles, and then the apostles in turn laid on hands to pass the Holy Spirit. So we have a succession down to those of us in the laity who are baptized. However, when we get to the Martin Luther era, the 1500s, 16th century, or we get to Henry VIII, who actually got bishops to go against their orders and to ordain Anglican priests. When you look at the sacrament, intention is involved, so those orders are invalid. But when you look at the other Protestant sects, they don't even have that pretense at succession. So does not all of their laying on of hands reduce to superstition and voodoo?
Okay, thanks. I can answer that. So first of all, with respect to Anglicans, it wasn't Henry VIII that vitiated Anglican orders. Henry took the church into schism, so they left their obedience to Rome, but you can be a schismatic and still retain valid orders. And so the priests that and the bishops that followed Henry would have retained their orders, and even those initially ordained would have retained valid orders in Anglicanism, and Anglicanism had a shot at being a legitimate but schismatical church. Legitimate in the sense that they could have retained valid orders and valid priesthood and valid sacraments and just been in disobedience to Rome. And there are other groups in the world that would meet that same description today. Uh-huh. But they lost it under King Edward, not under King Henry. Because in the Edwardine ordinal, the rite of ordination in the Anglican Church under Edward, they shifted the theology of ordination in the Mass to a Calvinist understanding of the Mass and of the ministry, and therefore they vitiated the sacrament. And so it's at that point that Anglicanism lost their valid orders. It's also not entirely true that other Protestant traditions don't retain some pretension of succession. And this is a common misunderstanding, actually. I mean, when I grew up in the Presbyterian Church, and if you had told me that the Presbyterians had a sort of sacramental apostolic view of ecclesiology, I would have told you were out of your head. And then I actually went and started studying the original documents and the writings of the founders, and John Calvin in particular, and found out that they really very much wanted to retain everything of Catholicism that they could retain without abandoning their core Protestant convictions. And so I don't think they did it coherently, but they actually made a stab at keeping a concept of succession. I'll talk about that a little bit on the other side of the break.
Yeah, Steve, stick with us. We'll continue that on the other side. We've also got room for your phone call at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Glad you're with us for Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Still time for your phone call, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. 888-298-3986. Before the break there, we were talking with a listener who had some questions about Anglicanism and orders.
Yes, and also the practice of laying out on hand,
yes,
on hands, and whether,
yes,
or not it was rank superstition.
Right, right.
So we're talking about the validity of Catholic orders, the invalidity of Anglican orders. And I was pointing out, the listener had made some comments about the lack of any concept of succession in other traditions of Protestantism, and I was saying that's actually not true. Early Protestants did retain a concept of succession. They modified it to accommodate their Protestant dogmas, but they still wanted to have the idea of apostolic succession, and they tweaked it, but they kept it.
Okay.
Interesting little anecdote from the history of the Protestant Church in France. After the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, when Louis XIV had made Protestantism illegal again, and it was highly persecuted in France, it survived in little tiny pockets in the south of France, particularly kind of in the rural areas and up in the mountains, and it got kind of crazy, right? It got kind of wacky, and people preaching apocalyptic prophecy and kind of running around and hooting and hollering, and it got kind of wild. And there was a reformer named Antoine Court who wanted to sort of reorder the French Reformed Church and kind of bring it back in line with Calvinist orthodoxy.
Uh-huh.
And he did this. He kind of sort of got the thing organized again on standard Protestant lines. But he wanted to make sure they had a properly ordained clergy to pastor these people. Fascinating event in the life of the French church. He didn't just ordain them himself. He sent them to Geneva.
What?
To receive ordination in Geneva, and then brought them back to the south of France. And when I read that, when I was reading the biography of Antoine Court years ago, I realized he's got a concept of apostolic succession.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's the wrong one.
Yeah.
You know, it's the wrong one. Like he's not sending these people to Rome to be ordained by the Pope.
No.
But he was sending them to Geneva to be ordained by people who were in the line of Calvin.
Wow.
And I thought, that undercuts everything I thought I knew about early Protestant ecclesiology. You know, it's fascinating.
It is.
But the question, is it all just rank superstition? Well, superstition is irrationality in our religious acts and our religious faith.
Yeah.
In the case of these Protestants, like Antoine Court, for example, I think that Court was wrong. I think he was incorrect in his ecclesiology. But he had a rationale that was grounded in an understanding of Christian history and Protestant dogmatics, which, after all, is derivative of Catholic dogmatics. So
yeah.
I think he made some significant errors. Better to have a doctrine of apostolic succession than not, even if you have the wrong one.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so one of the things that made me Catholic was studying the roots of my own tradition. As I dug into early Presbyterianism, I said, this stuff is much more like Catholicism than the Presbyterianism I'm living today.
Mm.
So much so that if John Calvin showed up in my church, I don't think they'd let him teach Sunday school, right? Because it's not the doctrine that we're preaching. I mean, he was a much more Catholic thinker than modern Presbyterians. And so even though I think he was incorrect about a lot of things, that witness to his pretended Catholicity influenced me to consider the question of Catholicity more seriously, and ultimately led me into Catholicism. So,
wow.
If it was a superstition, it was in my case a salutary superstition that led me personally closer to the truth of Catholicism.
Fascinating. Thanks so much for your call. It is called Communion here on EWTN. Still time for your phone call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We often ask the question, what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic? Think about that and give us a call, 833-288-EWTN. Hey, congratulations going out to another great EWTN radio partner celebrating 20 years with us. This would be KQOV. QOV stands for Queen of Victory, 98.5 FM, serving Butte, Montana. Congratulations to Tom Downey and Brandon DeShaw and everybody there at Queen of Victory Radio from your friends here at EWTN. Let's go to Houston now and talk with Darrell, who's watching us on YouTube today. Hey, Darrell, what's on your mind, sir? Darrell. Hey, Darrell. Hey.
Just a quick question. It's a twofold. You have things that, like, related to the brown scapular, different types of novenas, and if you have this for this amount of time, or if you say this amount of time, then your prayer will be granted at this time. What can you say to when you have things like that, like do this and this will happen, and you have that, and then the other question is different. In the Apostles' Creed, that Jesus descended into hell. Why is that part of? Why is that a credo statement? Why is it critical?
Yeah, great questions. Both.
If you understand those two things.
Yeah, great questions both. So with respect to novenas and devotions that include that are sort of grounded in a private revelation, where there are promises made, you do this X number of times and blah, 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 blah. How should we regard that in the Catholic tradition? If you took those statements without qualification at face value, right, so that all I needed to do was the mechanical repetition of a ritual, and I would guarantee, say, my salvation or somebody else's salvation or whatnot, that would be deeply superstitious.
Sure.
Are there people who take them that way? To be sure. You will find superstitious people in every tradition, including the Catholic tradition. What the Church has always said about such things is that we must hold to divine revelation, public revelation, not private revelation, and the deposit of faith and the dogmas of the Church. They are primary. They are the reference point with which we interpret everything else, including small t tradition. And so we can use these kind of devotions and these kind of private revelations, and we can use them to great effect. But we have to use them in a way where we interpret them in light of the dogmatic tradition, not the other way around. Mm. And so what the dogmas of the faith tell us is that if you want to be saved, you must be transformed in charity. You have to love God and love neighbor. Right? That is the sine qua non, and that is the whole show. If you've got that, you've won the race. Love God, love neighbor, you've got it made. St. Augustine, in Book 1, Chapter 35 of his On Christian Doctrine, says that everything else in the Catholic tradition we should regard, and this is a quote, with a transient feeling, the same as that we would have towards roads or carriages or other things that are merely means. They are means to an end.
Okay. Right?
But the end is transformation in love. Doesn't St. Paul say the same thing? If I have faith that can move mountains, if I have knowledge of all mysteries, if I have strength and helps and gifts, but I don't have love, I'm nothing.
Yeah.
All right. St. Francis de Sales, Doctor of the Church, great spiritual writer, in his Introduction to the Devout Life, asks the same question. He says, is true devotion a matter of saying rosaries or novenas or going to Mass or giving alms or fasting? No. All these things are means to an end. What's the end? The end is transformation and charity, love of God and love of neighbor. That's what true devotion consists in, right? So if I use these things, these promises, these practices, these prayers to great effect, such that they transform my life in charity, so much the better. But if I take them in a superstitious way and imagine that, you know, I can do this thing and then let off being charitable, then that's terrible. Now, are there people who take them that way? Yes, and that's awful, right? Why is the doctrine of the descent into hell critical? Well, first of all, what does it mean? It means that Christ descended to the limbus of the fathers to preach salvation to the spirits held in prison, namely the righteous dead of the old covenant. You know, Moses and Elijah. Well, not Elijah, maybe not Elijah, but Moses and you know, Isaiah and Abraham and all these characters. Right? Why not Elijah? Well, he got taken up in a fiery chariot.
Special case.
Special case. Enoch also is maybe a special case. But so that's the point of the thing. Why is it critical? Why put it in there? So, well, if you didn't know it, would you be damned to hell? Well, no, you wouldn't be damned to hell if you didn't know it. But all the dogmas of the faith have some utility. They translate into our spiritual life. And there's a very, very strong tradition, particularly in the Christian East, of identifying with Christ in his descent into hell. Right, that this is not only a sort of an act in eschatological cosmology. You know, he's not just traversing, you know, celestial geography for the view, right? But that actually mirrors something that has to take place in our own life. That as Christ descends to the depths, that we also descend with him into the depths of our own lives, the depths of our own personality, the depths of our own sinfulness. We die to those things with Jesus and rise again with them to new life. There's a priest who's often on EWTN that I like very much, Father Emmerich Vogt, and he said, religion is for people who don't want to go to hell, and spirituality is for people who have been there. You know, and what he means is, you know, you start in the religious life, maybe you have a kind of a naive conception of, well, I just do these things and I'll get to heaven when I die. And then you get, you know, 30, 40 years in and your life is quite difficult and very painful. And you realize, well, no, I don't just want fire insurance. I need the transformative power of God in my life right now, because the life, I mean, I'm not afraid of hell because what I'm going through is seems to be a living hell already, right? It was so bad. I need that power of death and resurrection going on in me now, today. And so you begin to really embrace the spirituality of the church and make it your own and incorporate it into your personality. And you're kind of, as it were, experiencing this descent into hell in your own life, but you cling to that hope and resurrection as well. So that gets pictured in a lot of the church's liturgy, particularly in the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom and the iconography of the Christian East, this whole idea of Christ's descent into hell and the defeat of the hostile powers and his victory over sin, death, hell, and the devil is very much incorporated into the spiritual sense of the people of God.
Durrell, thanks so much for your question. Glad that you're listening to us in Houston. Call to Communion here on EWTN. You know, one of the great bedrock programs of Catholic radio is the fantastic Catholic Answers Live, where Cy Kellett takes your calls and talks with some of the leading apologists and theologians in the church today. And of course, EWTN, very proud to be the exclusive radio home for Catholic Answers Live. You can hear it on EWTN Radio every weeknight, 6 p.m. Eastern, on EWTN Radio. Let's go to Cecil now in Murrieta, California, listening on YouTube. Hey there, Cecil, what's on your mind today? Cecil in California, are you there? Why don't we put him on hold, if you would, please, Pedro. We're going to go on to Kim in Kansas, and Kim is listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Hey, Kim, what's on your mind today?
Hi, good afternoon. So my question is kind of a two-part question. First, is the Catholic Church considered to be woke? And then kind of in the same idea of that is, how can there be different churches, different denominations, for example, maybe Methodists and Presbyterians, that serve God and Jesus, that yet have very liberal views and values, and they do things that I would consider very immoral based on my biblical beliefs? And so I'm just kind of trying to understand how we all fit together, but yet have such drastic beliefs.
Sure.
Sometimes.
Sure. Okay. So the word woke, of course, is a highly ideologically charged word.
It's loaded.
It's a very loaded word. And I'm going to propose a definition, and then I may back down this definition a little bit.
Okay.
That I actually found in the blog of the Catholic philosopher Edward Fazer. And Fazer is a unambiguously right-wing person, all right? So
yes.
That is coloring his understanding of wokeness. And there are people on the left who would clearly not own this definition, right?
All right.
Here's his definition. Wokeness, writes Fazer, is a paranoid, delusional, hyper-egalitarian mindset that tends to see oppression and injustice where they do not exist, or to greatly exaggerate them where they do exist.
Too bad he doesn't have an opinion on this.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Now, that would clearly be, you know, a conservative take on the woke phenomenon. I think someone who is on the left would say, we agree with everything about your assessment insofar as, yes, we think that we are people who are hyper-focused on oppression and injustice, and you know, we seek out marginalized identity groups that we believe have been historically oppressed or disadvantaged, and we want to right those in the social sphere. We would disagree that that it's paranoid delusion, or that it's a sort of an obsessive sort of hyperfixation. That would be the right-wing critique, and that would be kind of the left-wing answer.
Okay.
But what they would both agree on, I think, is that wokeness, however you take it in the common parlance, means this sort of laser-like focus on the question of the oppression of minority groups, and then kind of the sort of infinite hair-splitting of definitions of identity groups that you can, you know, keep finding new groups to whom you can assign the oppressed status. That's sort of the core element of so-called wokeness.
Okay.
Is the Catholic Church as an institution woke? No. Is it not woke? No. Is it left wing? No. Is it right wing? No. Can you locate it anywhere on the left-right ideological political spectrum? No. And Pope John Paul II wrote an encyclical where he in part discussed this. It was called Solicitudo Rei Socialis. You might go pick it up and read it.
Okay.
Where he talks about the church's social doctrine. And he says, look, the Catholic Church's social doctrine is not left-wing. It is not right-wing. It is not moderate. It's not in the middle. It's not splitting the difference between left and right-wing. To try to locate it on that ideological spectrum is a category mistake. It's like asking if the Catholic Church is more or less blue.
Yeah.
Like, that's the wrong adjective.
Right.
You know,
right.
Okay. Now, are there individual Catholics that are this like blindingly reactionarily conservative? Yes. Are there Catholics that are ravingly, insanely leftist? Yes, they both exist. They both exist. To the extent that an individual Catholic, be he or she left-wing or right-wing, insists on reading the church's social doctrine in a narrowly ideological way, and that could be right-wing or left-wing,
yeah,
then that Catholic would be departing from the spirit of interpretation that John Paul has authoritatively given the church.
Okay.
Right? And so how would that translate? Okay, so the church typically doesn't make policy pronouncements in, you know, about individual nations. Mm-hmm. Well, the United States should pass this law. Occasionally, they do. You might find, I mean, I remember, you know, Pope Francis, you know, kind of ran around and made a lot of noise when he was Pope about particular policy interventions in the United States government. Sometimes he would get quite vociferous about it. And as a Catholic, you know, what I would do with that is I would listen to the Pope, hear what he had to say. I would, because he's the Pope, and I have an obligation.
Sure.
I have an obligation to grant what's called a religious submission of mind and will, which is to grant that he's the Pope and I'm not, and he's the mouthpiece and I'm not.
Yes.
But I'm not obligated as an individual Catholic to hold to his particular policy point of view. That's not a dogma of the church. I mean, I have to listen to it respectfully, but I'm allowed to find fault with it. Right, and many Catholics have over the centuries found lots of fault with papal pronouncements about political policy. But for the most part, the church doesn't intervene at the level of policy. And so there might be a value that I have to hold as a Catholic. Let's say the value of pro-life. Like, I have to hold to the sanctity of human life and the value of, you know, it is unambiguously wrong to abort children. That doesn't necessarily mean that I have to sign on to every construal of every so-called pro-life bill that every pro-life congressman proposes, right? Because I could legitimately argue, and I'm not talking about any particular piece of legislation here, that I agree with the goal, but the means that you're trying to use to achieve that goal, I think, are imprudent.
Okay.
Right. Like, we both think there shouldn't be abortions, but I want to go about accomplishing that goal differently than you do. That's a legitimate position for a Catholic to take. But when the church is in the grip of, say, a political party or a political agenda or an ideological agenda, those kind of distinctions can become obscured. And so the well-meaning, Orthodox, faithful Catholic, if he doesn't go along with the ideological crowd, can be viewed as, oh, well, that guy's a liberal because he's not voting with us. Well, maybe he's more conservative than you are in some very fundamental way, right? But because he's not a yes man, he gets stuck with a label. This is the kind of, and same thing can happen on the left. Same thing can happen on the left, right? We might say, for the church says, for example, that homosexuals should not be unjustly discriminated against. That's in the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
Yes.
So any good Catholic ought to agree with the statement, homosexuals should not be discriminated against. And a person could be on the ideological left and hold that position and be a Catholic. But then let's say there's other people on the ideological left that says, and we're going to tell you what that means in practice. We're going to define in policy what it means to not discriminate. And you go, well, wait a minute. I'm not into that. I don't agree with that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not down. I'm not good with the discrimination. But I think what you're describing, the policy means you're trying to bring up, I think that conflicts with other Catholic doctrines.
Yeah.
And then he gets blackballed and considered by his party to be, well, now he's a raving conservative, when the conservatives over here would never recognize that guy. You see? I mean, so these are the kind of things the Pope says, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't get all hung up in your little ideological party spirit,
yeah,
where just because somebody's on the other side of the political aisle, you demonize them. And that kind of my side bias is ripping the country in half. It's ripping the world apart, and it's very bad for the internal life of the church. St. Paul says we should agree on everything, right? And that to do that in practice, you have to do what St. Augustine said, which is agree on the essentials, unity, and in all things, charity.
Sure. Appreciate that. Kim, thanks so much for your call from Kansas. Let's go back to Cecil in California. Cecil, are you with us there, sir?
Yes. So sorry.
That's okay. Go right ahead.
Yeah, so I really appreciated what you were saying the other day, Dr. Andrews, about the fact that God created us because he wanted to love us. We're not saved by faith alone. It's because of God's great love for us. And I also was wondering, though, I do counseling, and sometimes I question this idea of agency and how, you know, I think it's maybe a both and, but maybe you could unpack that for me in terms of, on the one hand, God wants to displace me and he wants to increase and I need to decrease. On the other hand, the more I have God, the more I become who I truly am. So maybe if you don't mind unpacking that a little bit, I'd appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So one of the things that distinguishes Catholicism from certain versions of Protestantism, like Calvinism, for example, is that Calvinists historically are monergistic. That's the technical word, monergistic, in their soteriology.
Oh, my.
Big words.
Yeah.
Okay? Soteriology is the doctrine of salvation. Monergism means that there is one agent, namely God, so that in the work of your salvation, it is 100% God's job and not yours, that you are basically a passive recipient, and any phenomenal experience of agency is kind of an illusion, right? Because it's ultimately God that's working in you and through you, right? And he's activating your agency 100%, you know, against your will, basically. And in fact, Calvinism teaches that grace is in fact irresistible. Grace is irresistible. The Catholic Church has always rejected that view, and the Catholic Church is synergistic, meaning there's God's agency and there's our agency, and that they work together to bring about the sanctification of the soul. And I can't do it without God's help. And God won't do it without my cooperation.
Mm, yeah.
And if, you know, to cash that out metaphysically, to get into the deep philosophy of it, is probably beyond the scope of this call, right, in the scope of this show. Mm. That's a very complex philosophical question. But there are some pictures we can paint that I think are helpful illustrations. One that a friend of mine gave me years ago that I thought was quite beautiful. Imagine the father who is doing yard work, and he is pushing a heavy wheelbarrow up a hill, and he's, you know, digging and sweating and huffing and puffing. And here comes the 3-year-old. Daddy, I want to help. Oh, great. any father who has been in this situation, and you know how much you value juniors' help at that point,
sure,
right? Well, you don't value it, you know, for the horsepower he's going to put into
right,
it, right?
Right?
What you value is the spirit. What you value is his eagerness to be involved and
sure,
to take responsibility and to be a part. That you love. It's actually an inconvenience to you that he wants to get between you and the wheelbarrow. So you find a way to accommodate him because you love the child. Kid puts out his hand, starts pushing on the back of the wheelbarrow. You're trying desperately hard not to slip and fall on top of him. And together, the two of you get the wheelbarrow up the hill. Now,
yeah, yeah.
You know enough about physics to know that the kid's agency contributes something. I mean, it's inconsequential.
Yeah.
You do 99.999% of the work, but he's doing 0.00001.
He's doing something.
And that's not nothing.
That's
you
right.
Know? It's real agency. It's real cooperation.
Yeah.
Now, what happens over time? Kiddo gets out there and starts, you know, pushing on that wheelbarrow every day. Well, it's 0.00002.
Yeah.
And then one day it's 0.1, and then one day it's 0.9, and then one day it's 1%, and then it's 10%. And I've got an athletic son who now could put me and the wheelbarrow and a horse on one shoulder and carry us all up the hill.
Yeah.
You know? And that's, you know, we don't ever get to that point with God. but you're right. As we start cooperating with God in becoming who we're really meant to be, we become who we are better and better, more and more.
Cecil, thanks so much for your call from California. We could not get to Barbara in Auburn, Massachusetts. We invite her to call us up on our next show. We'll put Barbara at the head of the line when she does. We also got a question from Amika watching us on YouTube. We're going to hold that over to our next program as well. Hey, Dr. David Andrews, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
We do it on EWTN Radio at 2 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Friday. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Andrews. Thanks for joining us. See you next time here on EWTN's Call to Communion. God bless.